Welcome to Tales of the Resistance, a podcast that tells you stories of defiance and rebellion as little glimmers of hope in these trying times. I'm Amber Hunt. We've talked for over a year here about Americans fighting back against the Trump family's grift, but this time, the resistance is coming from Albania. For weeks, Albanians have been taking to the streets every single night to oppose a luxury resort development linked to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, planned for a protected stretch of the country's Adriatic coastline, a wetland home to flamingos, Mediterranean monk seals, and sea turtle nesting sites. Activists dub it the Flamingo Revolution. On June 21st, protesters escalated by storming the construction site and vandalizing it, smashing windows and tearing apart equipment. They don't seem very remorseful about it. Night after night, crowds have gathered chanting "Albania is not for sale," a slogan they've projected directly onto the facade of the Prime Minister's office. The movement has expanded beyond the resort itself into a full anti-corruption uprising, with many protesters now demanding for the Prime Minister's resignation for greenlighting the deal with no public consultation and no transparency. The pressure is producing results. The bulldozers have pulled back, the fencing has come down, and the Narda Lagoon has been reconnected to the sea. Albania's anti-corruption prosecution office has ordered the seizure of assets worth 128 million euros from the landholding company behind the project. A similar Kushner-linked luxury development in Serbia collapsed under public pressure after parliament passed a special law to enable it. The Flamingo Revolution apparently knows that history. The Trump family is learning that their brand travels, and so does the resistance to it. The families of children murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary School are owed more than $1 billion in damages from Alex Jones, the man who spent years telling his audience the shooting was a hoax, that the grieving parents were crisis actors, and who profited while his followers stalked and harassed those families. To this day, they have not received a single penny. On June 18th, The Onion decided it was done waiting for the legal system to fix that. The satirical publication that created my all-time favorite t-shirt, Your Favorite Hymn Sucks, which I wore as a barista serving coffee on Sundays as a high schooler, has been trying to acquire InfoWars since 2024, winning a bankruptcy auction, having it thrown out, striking a licensing deal with a court-appointed receiver, and watching that get blocked too when Jones appealed to the Texas Supreme Court. Collins said Jones is basically holding InfoWars.com hostage. So he announced it will launch its own version of InfoWars on July 2nd, that's a few days from now, with or without a judge's permission. The new platform will route more than $100,000 to the Sandy Hook families immediately, drawn from the rainbow-colored InfoWars merchandise the paper has already been selling in anticipation of the takeover. Comedian Tim Heidecker of Tim and Eric fame will serve as creative director, hosting a parody of Jones's old show. Now, Jones himself broadcast what he called the last official InfoWars show on April 30th, shirtless, calling The Onion body snatchers and vowing the takeover would backfire big time. His new site draws a fraction of InfoWars' old traffic. The machine Alex Jones built to terrorize grieving parents is about to become a comedy network. Finally, people can laugh at InfoWars for all the right reasons. About 2,000 food and beverage workers at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, California, did something American workers have never done before. They struck a deal saying that if ICE shows up and threatens them, they get to strike. The workers, represented by Unite Here Local 11, were already in a contract fight when they learned that then-ICE director Todd Lyons had told Congress the agency would play, quote, a key part in security at the 2026 FIFA World Cup, which SoFi is hosting. That was enough. Workers voted 96% in favor of authorizing a strike, and their union co-president Kurt Peterson made their first demand clear, no ICE on the work site.
But I can say that this is a historic agreement. Even after ratification, they will retain the right to strike if ICE or DHS threatens their safety.
The agreement was reached just days before the U.S. men's team kicked off against Paraguay. It includes the largest wage increases at any NFL stadium in history. Most workers will earn over $40 an hour within 2 years, with tip workers seeing raises of at least 30%. The contract also puts hard limits on subcontracting and bans the use of automation and AI to replace workers. But the headline is the ICE part. For the first time in modern American labor history, a collective bargaining agreement contains an explicit right to strike if ICE or Border Patrol activity at the worksite threatens worker safety. Legal scholars are calling it unprecedented. The union is calling it a floor, not a ceiling, because SoFi is hosting 8 World Cup matches, and its contract sets a precedent that other World Cup venue unions across the country can point to. ICE has detained roughly a dozen Unite Here Local 11 members over the past year, so these aren't abstract politics for the workers grilling hot dogs and pouring drinks at the biggest sporting event on American soil. This contract was personal, and they got what they came for before they had to walk out. The Trump administration spent months calling its war with Iran a skirmish, a short-term excursion, the kind of thing you don't need to go to Congress about. Well, on June 3rd, the House of Representatives decided it was done waiting for an invitation. Members passed a War Powers Resolution, 215-208, directing the president to end U.S. military hostilities with Iran. 4 Republicans broke with their party to make it happen: Tom Barrett of Michigan, Warren Davidson of Ohio, Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, and Thomas Massie of Kentucky, whose re-election campaign Trump successfully destroyed. Here's Barrett after the vote.
You know, I'm taking into consideration a lot of factors: the constitutional parameters of this, the War Powers Act, the articulation of time that that gives to delegate to any president before Congress would have to act. The War Powers Act is very clear in that regard.
Asked if he's worried about taking off Trump, he added,
"You know, I vote my conscience for what I think is right, and I'm willing to accept that."
Now you might be saying, "Hey, Amber, isn't the war already over?" Well, a memorandum of understanding signed June 17th at, of all places, the Palace of Versailles, has Trump claiming the war is effectively over. He says he won. Iran is also claiming it won. Neither side has released a physical copy. Iran hasn't confirmed the U.S. version of the text. Switzerland peace talks collapsed before they started. Israel is still bombing Lebanon. And Trump, asked at the G7 whether he would abide by the deal, said, quote, "It's a memorandum of understanding. If I don't like it, if they don't behave, we'll go right back to dropping bombs right smack in the middle of their head," end quote. But hey, the House vote means something, right? Yay! This next one is a matter that I, as a former consumer affairs reporter, care about probably more than most. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It was created after the 2008 financial crash to keep banks and lenders from screwing over regular people. Well, the Trump administration has been trying to kill it since the start of the second term, but they keep losing in court. On June 19th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit delivered the latest setback, blocking the administration's revised plan to immediately slash the CFPB's workforce by about 2/3. That plan was already a scaled-back version of an earlier attempt to cut up to 90% of employees, which a district court judge had also blocked in March of last year. The administration's argument is that the CFPB is a politicized burden on free enterprise. Consumer advocates' counterargument is that without it, lenders go back to the kind of predatory practices that collapsed the housing market and wiped out retirement savings for millions of Americans. The court appears to find the second argument more compelling. The case goes back to district court with no deadline imposed on the judge, which means the CFPB's roughly 1,500 remaining employees keep their jobs, and the agency keeps functioning, at least for now. The administration has also been trying to drive resignations by ordering all staff to relocate to the Washington headquarters. That hasn't worked either. It's been a tough run for the people who want to make it easier to steal from consumers. Back in May, the Justice Department announced a $1.776 billion fund, cute number, to compensate people the Trump administration claimed were victims of weaponization. In practice, this meant funneling taxpayer money to the president's political allies and January 6 participants. The public backlash was immediate and loud enough that Acting Attorney General Todd Blanch announced the fund was, quote, not moving forward, period, end quote. Then reporters asked Trump if it was really dead, and he said he didn't know. Sources told reporters the administration was privately exploring alternate ways to deliver the same money through different channels. Well, federal judge Leonie Brinkema of the Eastern District of Virginia had been watching all of this unfold, and on January 12th, she extended her block on the fund indefinitely, specifically because none of Blanche's statements declaring it over had been made under penalty of perjury. The judge noted the fund might simply come back under a different name. Democracy Forward, which brought the case, called it a massive win, ensuring hard-earned tax dollars stay out of the hands of the president's cronies. The administration's plan to pay its allies with your money is currently blocked, legally dead, but apparently not legally dead enough to satisfy a federal judge. Which tells you something about how this administration makes promises. The National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, is home to about 830 scientists whose job is to study the Earth's atmosphere, weather prediction, climate modeling, the kind of work that tells you a hurricane is coming before it levels your city. Scientists call it the mothership of atmospheric research. The Trump administration decided it should be broken up. See, it was releasing news they didn't like. They called it climate alarmism. So the administration moved to transfer control of the NCAR Wyoming Supercomputing Center in Cheyenne, a key facility for climate and weather research, to a third-party operator without explanation, without considering public feedback, and on a timeline that strongly suggested, in the court's opinion, that, quote, retaliation played at least some role, end quote. That would be retaliation for not immediately releasing Tina Peters, the former Mesa County clerk who was convicted on state charges for tampering with Colorado's election systems during the 2020 election. Here's Colorado Congressman Joe Nagus.
It is part and parcel to a larger plan of retaliation and intimidation of our state by the Trump administration.
Anyway, on June 1st, a federal judge found the National Science Foundation had acted illegally. It had never explained why the existing operator, the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, should lose control, and it had ignored the public comment process entirely. Carlos Martinez, a senior climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists who helped coordinate the defense of NCAR, called it a win, saying, quote, I hope this gives some hope and motivation for people who believe in science, end quote. It's an injunction, not a final ruling, but for now, the mothership holds. The story of how Minneapolis pushed back against the largest immigration enforcement operation ever deployed to a single American city has been told on this show before. 50,000 people marched in minus 20 degree weather. Workers shut down the airport. Clergy were arrested at the gates. And after 6 weeks of sustained community resistance, Operation Metro Surge ended. The federal government apparently has decided to try a new tactic, indictments. On June 16th, the U.S. Attorney for Minnesota announced charges against 15 people, including trade unionists, for their role in opposing the ICE surge. The top count? Conspiracy to impede federal officers. The evidence cited in the 94-page indictment includes attending worker assemblies at the United Labor Center. No officers were injured, few were actually impeded. But 15 Minnesotans are now facing federal charges for organizing. The labor movement's response was immediate. Minnesota AFL-CIO President Bernie Burnham said the Trump administration couldn't break Minnesotans during the siege, so now they're trying to break them in the courtroom. He vowed, quote, they will fail again, end quote. After the charges were announced, protesters gathered at the St. Paul Federal Courthouse, Defense Attorney Jordan Kushner told reporters,
"This is a fascist prosecution. People are being prosecuted for peaceful political dissent."
Of course, the regime hasn't had much luck making charges stick. In fact, just this week, a federal judge blocked attempts by the administration to subpoena Governor Tim Walz and other Minnesota state officials, accusing the Justice Department of using its investigatory powers to retaliate against state officials for not cooperating with the federal crackdown on illegal immigration. The Save America Act, which would require proof of citizenship to vote, despite the fact that it's already illegal for non-citizens to vote, has been Donald Trump's declared top legislative priority. He said he would refuse to sign any other bill until it passed. He pressured Senate Majority Leader John Thune to nuke the filibuster to get it through. He threatened Republicans who wouldn't comply. On June 4th, four Senate Republicans joined every single Democrat to kill it for the second time. I'll mention the holdouts' names for the record, though not for applause for doing the bare minimum. We've got Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Mitch McConnell, and Tom Tillis. Murkowski, for her part, said Republicans spent years opposing Democratic efforts to change the filibuster for voting rights legislation. She said she didn't support it then, and now she doesn't support it just because a, quote, different team is carrying this ball, end quote. The administration still plans to keep trying, as you can hear here from James Donald Bowman.
Why don't we try and at least force people to vote against it? One of the things that, you know, sometimes frustrates me about the legislative process is that people will go into it saying, this isn't possible, therefore we're not even going to try. Well, let's actually see. Let's try it. And if it's not possible, then let the people put their name on it.
Agreed, JD. Let's get their names on it. So this one's not so much a resistance win as much as a self-own. In April, the president decided the Lincoln Memorial Reflecting Pool, a 103-year-old national landmark, was absolutely filthy, and he ordered it painted American flag blue in time for the nation's 250th birthday. The renovation project expanded significantly beyond its initial public cost estimate of about $2 million to more than $14 million by the time the work was completed. After the new pool was unveiled, its blue tinge quickly became a familiar green. The paint peeled. Tourists and locals flocked to the pool for all the wrong reasons. Trump blamed vandals, as you can hear here during a press conference where reporters actually did ask him some questions.
National Guard and police have been all over the mall. How would these vandals have gotten so close to do something like that?
Do you have any proof of this?
We didn't have a lot of them then. Who would think that somebody would go into a pool and take a knife and start cutting it?
Do you have proof of that?
Yeah, we have proof.
Photos or videos?
Well, let's put it this way. When you have a 350, I think it's 350, not 250, a 350-foot slit from one end to the other, you think that's proof?
Yeah, reporters have been down there today looking for that slit that you mentioned. There's no evidence of it.
All you'd have to do is see the Parks Department. They'll show it to you. See the secretary. But I saw it. They cut it. They cut it very violently. The same thing with the floor. They cut it. And then they lifted it. They pulled it. And that's what it is.
Uh-huh. Then he accused an ABC reporter of trying to rip the rubber off the surface while the reporter was on camera covering the story. Among those who've been arrested, David Hearn, a 67-year-old three-time Olympic canoeist, detained for 5 hours after touching the water at the end of a bike ride.
As soon as I left the side of the reflecting pool and went back to my bike that was laid down on its side on the edge of the grass, three National Guard troops sort of materialized and started talking to me about, after I greeted them, they were talking to me about the park police wanting to talk to me. I didn't think I'd done anything wrong, so I had no reason to think I was going to be arrested, but I suggested we walk over toward the park police rather than waiting for them to come to us, and went over and furnished my ID, and kind of before I knew it, I was being handcuffed and realized I was being arrested.
As of today, the National Guard is patrolling the deck of the reflecting pool, which is being drained and repaired again just days before the 4th of July. The pool meant to reflect America is currently reflecting something, just not what they intended. We're going to close today where the movement is going tomorrow. On Saturday, June 27th, so the day after this episode drops, hundreds of marches, rallies, and demonstrations are scheduled across the country as part of the All of Us 250 mobilization. The timing's deliberate. It's America's 250th birthday, and this is a direct counter-narrative to the administration's version of that celebration, which redirected $100 million in congressionally appropriated bicentennial funds toward what organizers describe as Trump glorification projects. The All of Us 250 Coalition's answer is to go back to the founding documents themselves, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the actual history, all of it, including the parts this administration would prefer to whitewash. Major events are planned in Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Miami, and Oakland, with hundreds of local actions in communities from rural Nevada to coastal Florida. The resistance showed up in freezing-ass weather in Minneapolis. It showed up in courtrooms across the country, week after week, brief after brief. It even showed up on the floor of the House of Representatives. May it show up again tomorrow. Find an event at allofus250.org. Tales of the Resistance is a production of Grab Bag Collab. Please support us at grabbagcollab.com. This episode was written by me, Amber Hunt, and engineered by Amanda Rossman. We'll see you next month.